And we are back for an all new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira the Third.
I'm Louis Fertel, still.
And we are joined by, actually don't know how many times she's been on Keep It at this point, but Keep It All Star, Aminatu. So, hello.
Hello. I thought you were going to be like, it's Aminatu the Third. I too would like a number now.
Okay, you are also hosting a new podcast called When Diana Met from CNN. I thought I'd had enough of Diana, but if it's coming from you, then that's what I want. And also, it's something different. It's not, you know, like Diana in torment from the queen and her guards. It's Diana meeting folks. You know, this is like, you know, like Weekend with Marilyn shit.
It is. Diana was, you know, it's like her life was very tragic. She died when she was 36, she's literally my age. And she died with like two kids and like too much baggage and like the family in law from hell. But, you know, we're just in this moment where we're really reexamining what women's lives have been and how we're told about them in the media. And even though it's a, you know, Diana content year, Palooza, like everyone is jumping in. The show is like pretty personal. And, you know, it's just done differently. And we're looking at what we can learn about her life from these like tiny encounters. So, yeah, it's really fun to make.
Do you have any particular favorite Diana encounters, ones that would surprise us maybe?
I mean, maybe not surprise you, but one that really made me laugh is, and it's the first episode of the show, is when Diana and Camilla met for the first time. Oh. And Camilla took her out to lunch in London at a restaurant literally called Ménage à Trois. Like, it's two on the nose. It's just like two on the, like, that's like the ultimate mean girl move.
Camilla playing games right off from the jump.
Yeah, you know, it's like, why would you do that? And honestly, like, when I saw it in The Crown, I was like, wow, like, amazing fiction. And then it turns out, no, it's like nonfiction. And, it's just, yeah, I like that really did make me laugh a lot. But also, you know, it's like I've really changed my mind about Camilla as well. I was like, Charles and Camilla, star-crossed lovers. Good for them that they finally found each other.
Actually, you know what? I am like on this shift where I've been like on the Camilla train. I'm here for the Camilla songs because yeah, I will.
Camilla,
say,
is this Camilla Cabello? My man.
All right,
Camilla.
I will say
Camilla from The Real World. Yes,
yes, Camilla.
I will say that. First of all, I think of that like viral tweet where someone wrote, "I don't know who needs to hear this, but that lady's husband is not your man. It's not your soulmate." And someone responded, "Tell Camilla that." And
yeah,
as a soap opera watcher, I am constantly thinking of like the Camilla character, like this person in love, like a Charles in love with this woman. But there's also this other, you know, like very perfect, but also very troubled woman they're already with. You know, like passions would keep them together apart for 15 years. But when they finally get together, you got to support it.
I know. Also, you know, it's like passions. The Queen of England, she like really tried. She tried her best. And they were like, Charles, you can't be with this old lady because she's not a virgin. And we have like, you know, we have optics to keep up in this family. And so what did he do? He married the wrong person. And that's awful. It's like, you know, my feeling is when people get divorced, you have to send them a cake and like congratulate them, because guess what? That's the best thing you could do for yourself, is to not be in an unhappy marriage. Congratulations.
Elizabeth is Alistair Crane, okay? She's Alistair Crane from Passions.
For real. But I'm like, those two were playing to win, you know? I'm like, playing for keeps, and it's working.
During the Free Britney saga, I would see like unhinged gay men take screenshots of awful DMs they sent Jamie Lynn Spears, like about like how she wasn't there for Britney, whatever. And with that kind of thing in mind, with that like extreme fandom at play with these like sort of tabloid stars of the past, I am way more sympathetic to Camilla. I am like I worry about what people probably tried to express to her in any given moment of any given day, you know, as she was like treated like a passions villain.
Gay men in the 90s probably like cutting out magazine letters and mailing Camilla all the nasty words.
No kidding. Okay.
Original Stan. That's what's going on. You know, can we talk about Free Britney for 1 minute though? Because I have been really It's really wild that people who are so wrong, like, it's like every time I look into the Free Britney movement people, I'm like, wow, these people are wild and they don't know what they're doing, but they stumbled into something real here.
Correct. It's like the rare case where they like nailed it. Yeah.
They totally nailed it. I was like, it's mental illness, love, but they're all right. I was like, they were right. Britney was in bondage, but these people, were they the people to make the case? I'm not sure, but it worked out.
I mean, it's like watching a teen detective movie or something where you really should be minding your own business, but you're kind of right.
Yeah.
It's like you know go about it the wrong way, you know, and you are, you know, ignoring what like law enforcement is doing and you're ignoring actual clues and you're breaking into people's homes and you're accusing like other random people of murder, but you do actually stumble upon who committed the crime by the third act.
It's exactly Rear Window. If you've seen when like they're sitting there with the binoculars, they're like, I can't believe I'm seeing what I'm seeing. And then the detective's like, you have no idea what's going on in that house. Grace Kelly is dubious at first. And then eventually they're all in on it and loving the caper of it, which feels even dirtier. But then again, they were right. So,
but and you know what? Every Free Britney person seems like they are, you know, as wheelchair bound and hiding in a house.
with just their binoculars. Yeah,
When your internet
goes out,
her.
Ira, I'm gonna know exactly who did it. When your internet goes out and your microphone just like stops working forever. I'm going to know where, you know, it's like, who did you slander? The Free Britney community. So we're wrapping this up.
We hear them clomping up the steps. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to fall for this. Absolutely not.
I will just say, like, even as a Britney fan, you know, like a friend would text me and say, do you want to go down to the courthouse? You know, when she was, when the conservatorship was about to be ending, because, you know, like everyone was going down there in LA. And I was like, absolutely not. No. what part of my personality
you are admitting
you
on air that you
the
weren't
crowd?
There with us at the courthouse? You're admitting to everyone that you weren't there with us to show your support?
I was
sir.
Not at the courthouse, okay?
Wow.
In public?
Wow.
I don't know. That's where assassinations happen, outside courthouses, okay?
Huey Long, Wiki it. Yeah.
You two are a mess. A mess.
We're going to be a mess on this episode, I'm sure, because, first of all, we're going to talk about family dynasties, because, the Cuomos done got themselves into some mess.
What a fiasco. As in, I didn't think I was that interested in first, and then as it kept getting worse, I was like, well, I guess I have to keep obsessively reading about this. Wow.
I mean, fiasco is like actually a really good word, because if my sibling got like fired and then got me fired, I would burn our family to the ground. But this family is the opposite. They were like, we're jumping off the bridge together because we are wild. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it's just been like, I don't know. It's just also been really disappointing to see how people, like, how something that is actually a structural issue is being framed as a family issue. You know, being if my brother were in trouble, I would support him. I want to say that too. But if my brother was, like, credibly accused of being a harasser or assaulting women, I'm going to tell you now, there's a limit to my love. And I'm like, I'm not going to lose my reputation and my life over that. And also to watch this like family, the Cuomos, who's like very powerful New York family. I'm like, we have bridges named after you fools. Like, come on. Like, you're not nobodies. To watch them like play the victim and to play this like, we're just like nice brothers who are trying to be cool to each other and everyone's coming after us. It's just been really disgusting to see how that narrative is what's playing out. Not like they're actual Disney villains who are in charge of everything and everyone and abusing their power left and right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're going to get into all of that. We're also going to talk about two very wildly different celebrity profiles that came out this weekend, but sort of share a bit of the same themes. Jeremy Strong from Succession and Colton Haynes of Teen Wolf, Arrow fame. They both have profiles out and they are wild reads.
Yes, the Jeremy Strong one in particular, like you hold on to the desk as you read it. Like you're like, oh, I can't possibly find out another bone-chilling detail about this person. Oh, he's standing right behind Daniel Day-Lewis. Oh, okay. Yeah. Scream
you
6.
Daniel Day-Lewis cosplay the whole
thing. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we'll get into that.
It's like the Scream tagline. It's always someone you know.
Right.
It really is.
Your co-star,
well,
Lincoln.
Can I confess something to you, though? Can I confess something to you?
What?
I'm going to say something really shocking, but it's okay to be transparent. And we all, you know, it's like, it's okay. There's no shame. For years, I thought that Colton Bachelor and Colton Arrow were the same person.
Mm.
So I was like, first of all, there's two white men named Colton. That's shocking. That is just like, white names are wild. But I thought they were the same person. And it was while I was reading the Colton CW profile. I'm going to just call him Colton CW. It's when I was reading that Colton profile that I was like, oh, this is a different person. This is the one that did the blackface 3 times. And he's different from the one who had the docuseries about coming out. And so that was like...
You deserve credit for actually picking them apart now, because now Colton CW is doing something about coming out and Colton Underwood also has the show about coming out. So they've made it most confusing at this moment.
But if you want someone with a unique name, this episode, I also sit down to talk with Chrishell from Selling Sunset.
Love Chrishell, our queen.
We get all into what the fuck escrow is. I ask her about that Oppenheim brother she with. So we get into it.
Not you demystifying escrow for the podcast audience.
Yeah, whoa.
The people want
Susie
it now.
Orman, spell it out. Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back with plenty more Keeping. If you're looking for movies, television, and comic books to check out this holiday season, then listen to new episodes of X-Ray Vision with Jason Concepcion. This month, Jason will be discussing the new Marvel series Hawkeye, recapping previous Spider-Man movies, and diving into the new Spider-Man film, Spider-Man No Way Home, featuring Lewis's favorite actor, Tom Holland.
Oh, you can catch episodes of X-Ray Vision every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
We thought for our first topic today, we discuss two pieces concerning actors that have hit the web recently. Two of them from iconic television series, to be honest, Succession and Teen Wolf.
Oh, yeah. Always said in the same breath at the Emmys, for sure.
Listen, stranger things have happened. You never know.
Truly. But they are Jeremy Strong and Colton Haynes. Since Succession just aired on Sunday, and there was a little shocking twist, don't want to spoil it for people, but there was a shocking twist involving Jeremy Strong's character of Kendall Roy at the end of this week's episode. Let's start talking about Jeremy first.
Okay.
So Jeremy Strong, the profile, I will say, is fucking fantastic.
It's by Michael Shulman, who is like the definitive Meryl Streep journalist. He has a book about Meryl Streep. Anyway, you know, grade A New York gay.
Yes, and this is what you want from a celebrity profile, right? This is what the greats do.
Well, it's because it's like you actually learn something about Jeremy Strong, and the thrust of it in this piece is that he was growing up one of those actors who was obsessed with great actors, and so he was obsessed with Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, and in particular Daniel Day-Lewis, and it maps out somewhat ceremoniously all the ways in which his life then intersected with those people. And the piece itself compares his life to All About Eve. And you realize there's no way to write this without comparing it to All About Eve, because he's literally lingering outside their door like Eve Harrington in All About Eve.
I mean, this profile is really, you're like, one of you is like, it's fantastic. And the other one of you is like, yeah. I was like, this profile was unhinged, y'all. Like, this is, the whole time I was reading it, I just feel that actors have a sense of like, exactly what's going on when they're being profiled in this way, and they're more in control than you think they are. And with Jeremy Strong, I was like, it's they're like the Daniel Day-Lewis like worship, which of course I was like, you know, fabulous actor, like who, like great, great person to worship. But to like allow yourself to come across like one as a stalker and kind of as an original, like an unoriginal, I'm going to copy everything he does down to the bow tie when I win my award show. I was really surprised by that. I was like, this feels like a rookie mistake. Like you are not, you're kind of like not your own person. All I'm learning about here is just kind of how unhinged you are. The performance was like, it was not giving what I think he thought it was giving.
That's just it, though.
I left feeling very rattled.
Do you think he thought it was coming across as, I'm just a devoted actor, and obviously Daniel Day-Lewis is a great actor, so me admiring him just makes sense? Like, did he think it was going to come across as
100%,
like,
yeah. Like, that's what it came across. Like, that's what he was trying to do, because he, you know, like, imagine being like, I love Daniel Day-Lewis. I follow him. He was like on my wall. I also like did all these jobs to like get closer to him. And literally I'm just like mimicking him. But also I'm really discreet. So I'm not going to tell you any of the actual correspondence that we've had, or I'm not going to tell you what we, you know, like what we've done. And I was like, no, if you were discreet, you would like mention it in like a tiny soundbite and then never bring it up. And then there were also these like fantastic moments in the profile where clearly Jeremy Strong was trying to get all of his like high power, word, like, you know, other actor pals to talk to Michael Schulman.
I loved it.
You know, and Michael Schulman's like, it's hard to get in touch with these people because you got to call their agent, then you got to call their manager, then you got to do all this. And he's like, but no, but Jeremy Strong will like text them. And then Matthew McConaughey is calling me being like, yeah, he's like really cool. Like, there was just something about how the sausage is made in the profile that made him come across like, you know, like a little desperate, a little like power grabby. And again, it's, you know, like all of it is perception. Like, I don't know this person at all. But I think that like whatever he was performing, if he thought that it would be like some like cool, mysterious profile, I was like, no, all I made you come across as is like another like thirsty actor, which is totally fine. It's like part of how you get work is by being, you know, it's like you kind of have to be in the world this way and people have to know you. But it was really tough to read coming from someone who like thinks that he's really self-aware. I was like, no, you're coming across like unhinged right now. And I'm loving it. But I don't know if he's loving it.
Well, so I loved it because for what it's engrossing, I feel like it was giving me a good, like you said, it's how the sausage is made. It was giving me a good breaking the fourth wall of not just celebrity profiles, but, you know, of like celebrity in general. You know, the fact that he's just handing over the numbers to Michael. And then you have people like Matthew McConaughey, like calling Michael while he's at an ATM. You have Michelle Williams talking about how he lived in her basement for years. You have Brian Cox on the show, who we already know has been spilling the tea everywhere, recklessly, just being like, you know, like, I'm concerned for him. And actually, I was concerned, and I was a little sympathetic. You know, there's the All About Eve element, but I saw him more as like the little J to Daniel Day-Lewis's Blair Waldorf, okay? I see him as like really trying to emulate his idol, but making a lot of missteps. I think if you dig deep into this, I think Damon Young tweeted about this a bit. Like, if you dig into like between the lines of this profile, you see someone with like severe social anxieties who seems to be only capable of being an actor. You know, when you read about what his life was like at school, when he was at Yale, you know, he seemed like very alienated from the rest of his classmates, very much like, the only thing that keeps me going is focusing on the work. And it actually maybe sort of paints method actors in a different light. Like, maybe it's not just this insane, like, I'm torturing everyone around you for the sake of art. Maybe it's also like, I'm torturing everyone around me because I'm secretly torturing myself.
Right. It's a way of functioning. Like, you choose an entire identity to be, and that gives you something to be, you know. There's like an emptiness,
a
void there.
It sounds insufferable.
Oh, no, of course it is.
It's just insufferable. But to them, how else are they going to survive? Because the other option is being themselves, which seems dark. You know, it's a mode of self-preservation.
But also, I would say something about the other actors commenting on him, the ones that he's like hooked up the profile writer with is all of their quotes are like tentative and not exactly glowing. Like Brian Cox being like, I'm worried about him. It's like, that's like the quote you wanted us to get from these people. It's so interesting, like how they all like are seemingly exchanging glances during this profile.
Well, he talks about how he's injured himself twice playing right. Kendall, and which it's wild how much he seems just like Kendall, because this season on Succession has been Kendall thinking that he is, you know, the white knight, saving the world from his evil father, and it blowing up in his face, like all of his interviews that he gives, you know, trying to get a good tweet, trying to think that he is like, you know, like cool and like really in touch with the culture, and the backlash against his father. And it culminates this fucking week on the show where he tells his father, like, you're evil. While also saying, like, you're evil, I want nothing to do with this family, cash me out and you'll never hear from me again. And it's like, baby, where you think that money you want to get cashed out is coming from?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the
it's
evil
like
daddy.
You're convinced that you're the good one and your entire life has been predicated on the evil father fixing your mistakes, like the fact that you killed somebody two seasons ago. Okay, like, come on.
Allegedly, Ira, allegedly. but you know what I mean? I guess like the reason that it was a little hard for me to digest that profile, like, or to have some sort of like sympathy for him is that, like, yeah, it's, you're right. It's like there's this like coming up era where he's like living in the Michelle Williams basement. He's striving, he's doing all the things. And there's a part of me that like respects that, you know, at the end of the day, like successful people are mostly all strivers and that's fine. But to have him like, you know, I'm like, you're literally at the top of your game. Like you have won these like incredible awards, or even in the moments where he's rejected, you know, and you're like, oh yeah, he gets rejected from these roles from his like, you know, beautiful existence in Denmark. I'm like, I'm having a really hard time feeling sorry for you right now. But there's something about, if you just think about his workplace, like Succession as his workplace, and hearing his other colleagues like kind of describe their working relationship, where I was like, wow, like one person is like, I'm concerned for you. The other one's like, he seems to think that we're not making a comedy, but I think that we're making a comedy, where you really think of him as someone who is so disconnected from the reality of his own success and like the fact that he has arrived in Hollywood. There was just something about that like left a really bad taste in my mouth, where I was like, listen, I get it. Like everyone struggles for a while, but if you are, you know, like if you're like kind of like off the struggle, having a little bit of awareness of like, okay, like my path was hard, but now here I am and I'm trying to do better things, as opposed to just being the coworker that's like, I'm going to jump off of this thing and break my leg for the sake of art. And also I'm an insufferable coworker. Is there was just something about that where I was like, this man does not, I don't think that he thinks that this is not doing what he thinks it's supposed to be doing.
Well, also, I think a detail that is important to bring up is that when he was at Yale, he, I guess, invented some award to get Al Pacino to come, and it ended up almost,
that was amazing.
According to the piece anyway, almost bankrupting this Yale drama program that sponsored this or whatever. So it's not just that he was obsessed with these idols, it's that it was so driving everything about him that there's a feeling that he would stop at nothing and then be successful at getting near them. So anyway, there's something extra Succession-y about that, just the hard, like, gaunt with ambition kind of grimness.
Well, that's why I describe it as Gossip Girl. He's like, it's the wacky mad cat part of the episode where you're actually like, I could see that as a Gossip Girl episode, you know? It's like you are part of the Yale dramatist program. You're nearly bankrupting it, but it all works out in the end sort of for you in a way.
Right.
But the audience learns a lesson about ambition and what you shouldn't be doing.
You know, one part of the profile that was like really fascinating to me that I wish they had stayed a little longer on, because it kind of connects to the other profile that we want to talk about, the Colton profile, was this part about, you know, like Jeremy Strong and Captain America, Chris Evans, like being in the same, you know, like they were in the same like milieu, and, you know, and he caught like, and Chris Evans, like really looking up to him because he's like the talented one kind of in their like Massachusetts like cohort. And then, you know, and then he goes on to get a high powered agent and his career is happening. And there's like tiny detail in the profile that's like, yeah, like Hollywood is not kind to people who look like Jeremy Strong's, where it was like, oh. And to me, that was like, it was such a, like, that was the moment that I found myself, like, being really tender, actually, where I was like, oh, yeah, this industry is, like, rough. Like, it is so, you could be, like, as talented as fuck, but, like, it is really, you know, it's, like, do you swipe right or do you swipe left? And so much of that is, like, looks, is, like, looks based. Mm-hmm. And how, for so many years, he, like, actually, like, probably didn't work because he didn't have the, you know, whatever we think of as the iconic, like, American male lead, and how that has shifted so much also, but how even, like, that notion is kind of a scam. There was something about that to me where I was like, oh, I, like, this is, like, part of the central pain that is not, like, being fully explored here. And so many of these antics are also, like, you know, because there's so much that you can change about yourself, but, like, fully, like, changing, like, who you are and how you look, which is something that, like, Hollywood asks people to do, like, to do to themselves all the time. I was like, psychically, that is something that, like, really breaks you.
Which also, by the way, side note, painted Chris Evans in such a lovely light, too, because there's that yes! detail where he immediately, when he gets a call from Jeremy, is like, I'm hooking you up with my agent immediately. And then, like, the agent never calls Jeremy back, you know? But it's like, Chris Evans was like, I look up to you. Of course you should have an agent like me, because I'm hot, you know? And that's why I'm, like, in Not Another Teen Movie, you know, with my little whipped cream bra turning the gaze on. And on that note of Hollywood, you know, like, making you, like, change everything about yourself, that's why I think the Colton Haynes profile actually had a lot of the same similar themes as the Jeremy Strong profile, you know?
And he wrote it himself, I want to say, so it's not technically a profile. But the thing about the Colton Haynes thing, so basically he concealed about himself that he was gay because his management screamed at him to do so. He had sort of intended on being out, at least initially. What's weird about this is it confirms what you think is happening to people like this, which is like that, wow, you came out suspiciously late, or what is your problem with being gay? Like, is it really that much more important for you to be an actor than it is for you to be, like, out as a person, which feels like, you know, a concept from the Montgomery Clift, Anthony Perkins days or whatever. And you realize people are literally directly saying into these people's ears, you're too fucking gay. You move your hands like this, so that's also gay. And they're micromanaging how you get through not just your day, but, like, moment to moment who you are as a person, and saying it interferes with money making, essentially. And that is so clearly debilitating. Hearing Colton Haynes talk about how he was drug dependent and, you know, unemployed, how it didn't work out for him in a lot of ways, is, like, so gross. And also exactly what you think. That's what was so heartbreaking about it.
Not just that, but those classes. The description of the classes was, I think, the wildest part for me, because you hear the stories. You know, like, the Bryan Singer shit. You know about the parties, you know, where there's just, you know, like, young gay men who are just sort of, like, they're hoping, you know, like, you know, God, I hope I get it at the pool, you know, in, like, a Speedo or something, while some, like, gross executive or agent or manager's there. But the description of an acting class where you have to be naked and act out the scene from Monsters Ball in front of a class is wild. This is Clockwork Orange.
The wild.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, like, I think, like, the thing that both of these pieces, like, left me thinking about, the Colton, like, first account piece to write, it's on a profile. It's the first account, like, writing, and Jeremy Strong is also just, like, this is the problem with, like, workplaces that are not transparent at all, right? Colton especially, like, really gets to this where he's like, okay, I met with this guy and he was like, you need these classes and this, and he's like, oh, is this guy my manager now? Has he signed me? Like, there is kind of, like, no awareness of the relationship that he has with this person, right? Because it's like you get to LA and then, like, nobody really tells you, like what are the steps that are supposed to happen? It's all, like, mysterious or whatever. And then he goes to these classes and I was like, none of this is evidence-based, or even the evidence of, like, audiences will not go for gay men who play straight men, who, like, play straight men on TV. I'm like, do we actually know that for a fact? Or do we know that, like, creepy people just say that behind the scenes and then that's, like, what gets perpetrated, like, across?
Exactly. And that
it just, like, made me really sad.
There's the detail too that he's in the class with, like, he says, like, he's in, like, the class with someone who's already on a successful CW show, You know? Yes. So it's like this person is seemingly, quote unquote, made it, but they're still in this class. And then there's also the idea that these men who are telling him that are saying, like, you know, you can't make it if you're gay, or like beating down his mannerism, etc. But they seem to specifically pick young gay men to foster their careers, knowing that they can then beat them down. That's the method, you know. You beat, because if you wanted like a straight leading man, you'd find a straight leading man. You wouldn't keep finding gay men and beating them into straight leading men, you know,
like, right. You, or you do that because them. You're literally a predator, you know. Yeah. What I mean, where I was like, you do that because you're literally a predator, or you are a bully, or you are trying to destroy someone's spirit. And I was like, how, like, it's the perfect place to hide if you're like a piece of shit human who wants to exploit someone else. It's the perfect hunting ground. Reading Colton's piece, like, really left me, it left me feeling so sad and so awful. And, you know, and he's someone who's like problematic in his own right. I was like, your Tumblr antics will not go forgotten, you know. But there was just like, there was something about like, oh, like, here is everything that like makes a person. Like, here is, you know, and also, like, you know, it's like we all have the hindsight of like a couple of years. Like, I, for one, am like very grateful that I'm not who I was when I was 19, or I, you know, like, that's not what I want to be remembered for. Or I think about like that vulnerability when you're coming up in your career, you're trying to figure it out. And I'm not even trying to do something that's as public as those people, but it was like really useful context, you know? And you're like, oh yeah, like, you are trying to move in a world that it doesn't want you really to like move in it, but also you are surrounded by predators who will make money off of you if they can. And even if they cannot make money off of you, will like still want to extract some sort of value from you.
I will say that finding like sweeter sides of him over the past years, you know, have even made me recontextualize, you know, like, I used to make jokes about Colton Hayes. We all did, you know, in that early era before he came out, the jokes were very much in that vein of like, why won't this boy come out? You know, making the sort of internet jokes that people try to like make about Shawn Mendes now, you know, everything's a cycle. But it's just sad, and it's a little heartbreaking, and it just makes you feel, you know, a type of way about not just this, it's in every industry, you know? I mean, like, we've experienced this, Amina, in the media industry, you know? Like, the media does this to people in a different way, because it's not based on, like, your body as, like, capital, but it's, you know, it's like, what else is...
But it kind of is. It kind of is.
And stealing things for cheap labor. And even that story recently about the black girl who worked at Spotify and created Spotify Wrapped as an intern, and they were like, thank you for the idea, goodbye, bitch. You
know? Great contribution, please leave.
There also was something in the piece, he says specifically, my looks were the only thing I ever got validated about growing up. And I feel like because of that, or it's like, that's where these like predatory horrible manager types get off being horrible to you, because they assume on some level they're telling you they're hot, and that's all the validation you need before they like continue to ruin your life by like making you do things like wear a ripped cowboy shirt as you present papers to somebody's office, or whatever that part of the story was. But it's like, you know, like, oh, you're a like treating them like a piece of meat, saying that, like, you know, because you're an Abercrombie enough looking guy, that's all the validation you need. Now comes the real work. And it's like, wow, you really are not. There's just no way in which this person is even treated like a human being, even once. It just sounds like a miserable career he's had.
Shout out to growing up unattractive, you know, in high school. Yeah. Okay, you know.
Yeah, no, growing up black and fat is maybe the best thing that ever happened to my self-esteem, because there is something about like people not checking for you that also means that you get to be your own weirdo. But I don't know, it's like when I was like reading this Colton thing, I was like, I would die for like more men talking about like how the beauty ideal like affects them, like across the gender and sexual spectrum, because I do think that it's very instructive for everyone. And I think that it also, like, it just really lays bare some like really shitty like societal things that we do to each other. And there was just like some, you know, like there's just something about that that was like, oh, interesting.
I talked like, about this briefly a couple weeks ago, but you know, just in terms of like the Harry Styles profile, in terms of the Harry Styles, you know, like magazine covers, the idea that there's at least some transparent ways that we're trying to attack the beauty industry in terms of like what they do to women, you know, and you see like a Fenty show or companies mm-hmm. that are trying to be more inclusive, et cetera. I was just saying like what we've grown up as men, it really hasn't changed at all. The male beauty industry is still focused on looking like a Details magazine cover.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sticking with my guns on the fact that Harry Styles' style was originated by K.D. Lang and perfected them. So just go back to the K.D. Lang days to see a slick suit done well.
All right. When we're back, I sit down with the queen named after a gas station herself, Rochelle Stouse from Selling Sunset. And then there'll be more Keep It with Amina after that.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
From selling drama on soaps to selling open concepts and stunning views, today, Keep It welcomes the breakout star of Netflix's Selling Sunset and a friend of mine, Rochelle Stouse.
Hello.
Hi.
It finally happened. I'm so excited to do this with you today.
You know, it's funny when I think about how we met first too. It was, I think it was just Twitter, and it was just because we shared a mutual friend in Molly Burnett, because you were both on Days of Our Lives together.
Yes. RIP to your Twitter, by the way, which was the best feed of all time.
Thank you. I want to talk about that first though, because you went from soaps to, well, a docu-soap, basically, from all the drama that happens on this. How did you get into soap operas?
Well, actually, I mean, that was my goal. Like, even in college, I didn't say I wanted to be an actor. I always said I want to be on a soap, just because I would watch the shows. And that's why I love that we share, you know, the love for it. It's just a different, you know, I grew up watching these shows. And, you know, I just...
What did you watch as a kid?
So growing up, I watched Young and the Restless. And that was my mom and grandma's show. And then my grandma watched Guiding Light. And then in college, okay, I watched Days of Our Lives. So...
Okay, same. My household was like a CBS one. And then I got into Days of Our Lives on my own.
Yeah. And so it was funny when I booked all my children. That was the first one. It was actually one that I hadn't seen. But I was super excited. My mom was like, can you get on YNR? She didn't know how it worked. It was very funny. I was like, sure, I'll just put in the request.
What was it like? Well, so that's so interesting, because like when you worked on All My Children, was that pre-Hulu?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, okay. So before it was canceled, I don't think people realize like how different soaps are even now from back when you were on All My Children to, you know, even your current guest stints on Days of Our Lives. Because first of all, the sets are smaller.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the budget has been cut. The budget has been cut. When I joined All My Children, it was still, I mean, they still had money. They would throw these crazy parties. And so, you know, I started in 2005, and over the course of, you know, I've even just recently, you know, still like sometimes I'll pop into Days and stuff. So it's just kind of changed a lot, but it's still so fun. I still, you know, I just love, it feels like a little family over there with the different shows. So I don't know. I've always had a love for, you know, from a kid, you know, those kind of things impact you of what you look up to and those women. And, you know, I was very much the opposite growing up. So I was like, oh, I want to do that. I want to be, you know, one of those girls. So
well, you're also like the first person that I've had, I think, on from who's been like a current cast member recently on Days. So like, who were you excited to meet on the show? And then like, who ended up like surprising you as being like completely not what you expected when you joined?
I mean, obviously, you know, Deidre Hall is a soap icon. So of course I was super excited to meet her and work with her. And, you know, there's people like Christian Alfonso, who, you know, I remember seeing. I mean, she's just so that iconic beauty, you know, from that time period, and then just getting to see her. And that's who I would say surprised me the most, because I think Christian Alfonso was just in my head, like one of those women I'm talking about where I'm like, oh my God, like she's just so gorgeous. She's so talented. And she couldn't possibly be more lovely in real life. And so.
Oh, that's so sweet. So she wasn't one of the soap divas you mentioned on this season.
Not at all. No, she was the opposite, the most lovely person.
That's great. I love that. It's so nice to have like you as a part of Days of Our Lives.
I love it too. I love when you put stuff on your stories, I am always cracking up.
I still watch every day, and I have friends who are like, they only see the show. They remember it from like college or watching it as a kid, and they only see it through like my Instagram stories now.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I go in and out. I've been so busy. So lately that's the only way I see it too. But I always get a good laugh out of your stories with the day stuff.
All right. Well, switching to Selling Sunset now.
Yes.
First of all, girl, what is escrow?
Oh my God. This is the funny. This is my favorite meme that's come out, where it's, you know, Kathy Hilton saying instead of hunky dory, she's like, who is escrow? So escrow is a third party that when you enter into a transaction of, okay, I want to buy this house or I want to sell this house, it's the third party that you give the money to in the process, you know, because you have to give a deposit and then all these things happen. So it's basically like a safe, you know, a safekeeper of the money, so that, you know, you don't want to just hand some guy over that, you know, and then a lot of things could get messy. So escrow is basically the safekeeper of the money.
Okay. I sort of get it.
I'll
figure it out once it's time to buy a house.
We've gotten this so many times, it makes me remember, like, we should probably be a little more explanatory of, you know, these types of things that I forget.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about shooting the show, because I think when we watch something like Housewives, right, you see like more of their lives in a way. So you see them like getting into glam, you know, like for dinner and stuff like that. But on Selling Sunset, you're already in glam before you even start filming, right?
Oh yeah. They love the glam. I remember, you know, the first season showing up in like a sensible block heel to, you know, walk a property that was under construction. And Adam DeBello, our creator, was like, Chriselle, do you have any other shoes? And he literally sent someone out to like, was trying to find shoes. And I ended up wearing the block heel, but I just knew from that day on, do not ever wear a block heel to set. Because, you know, it's like, to him, it's a set. But to me, I thought, you know, I really thought it was a show just about real estate, and we're realtors and the properties under construction. You know, if you watch the show, you've seen there's been a progression of, oh, okay, I get it now. It is about real estate. But, you know, obviously he wants that soap. Yeah, that soap element to it.
Uh-huh. How is your like feeling about being on the show changed from when you first even shot it? Because like, what was the first season like when you first joined and you're like, we don't even know what this show is. And now it's like a global phenomenon.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when I was approached about it, you know, because the Oppenheim Group was all a company all working together, but they approached me to come join it. And so it was one of those things where it was told to me that it's about real estate and we're selling real estate. So, you know, as a side hustle, I was like, oh, what could go wrong? Like, you know, and of course I know it's been super successful and I'm super happy about it, but I just mean, I didn't understand that there was this personal element to it when I got into it. And so I really just thought, oh, I have nothing to lose. Like, it's about, you know, like I was thinking like an HGTV or like a $1 million listing. So, I had no idea. So I think that was the biggest thing that I kind of learned, you know, as we went, you know, now, of course, everyone knows, you know what you're doing when you step on to the scene, but, you know, it was a learning curve.
Well, if you even imagining it was like an HGTV kind of show when you first joined, like, what was it first like when, you know, your divorce first started happening, right? You know, was there a conversation with the producers like, this is happening in my life? Were they like, we would love if you would share this? Were you like, I don't know, like how we approach putting it on TV?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was a turning point for me because that's not something that I, you know, could even at the time fathom, talking through or sharing. So there had to be a lot of conversations before we got there. And they just, you know, went out of their way to make sure that they, you know, made sure that I knew it wasn't going to be sensationalized and like edited to make me look like I'm, you know. And so because I trusted that they would just, you know, here's how I feel and we're not going to try and make it, because sometimes that happens and it had happened in the past where something didn't happen that way and then they edited a certain way and you're like, oh my God. So this is one of those situations where I was like, you can't do that. Like, you know, So it was a lot of conversations behind the scenes, but I just think, you know, I feel like, you know, I hate talking about this because I feel like I've talked about it on end, but I'll just say, you know, and then if you don't answer the question, but then if you do, people are like, oh, shut up about it. But I just, you know, I just lost a lot. So Of course my initial gut reaction was to walk away, but then am I going to give up the one thing that I, you know, like really proud of and I have that can like make sure that I'm going to be okay on my own. So that was kind of what I wrestled with and obviously decided to with their,
I get it.
Yeah.
Speaking of like sensationalizing, like a relationship, it's funny then that like the season ends with like the big shocking trailer, about you and Jason dating. And I what's funny is that like I knew that was coming, but when I saw the trailer, the way that it was edited, like coming up in season 5, I was like, wait, did someone just die?
I know.
They really sold like some drama is happening.
I know. And they give it that movie aspect with the music and the, you know, the way it kind of pops in. So yeah, it was funny because I just assumed at this point most people knew, you know, it's been out there quite a bit, but you forget what a bubble you're in until it goes on Netflix into all these countries. And so many people had no idea and were really shocked by that moment. So I found that really interesting that in my bubble, I thought everybody knew. And it was, you know, Netflix is so global, you know, 192 countries, I think. So that was kind of interesting to me to feel like that was like some shocking ending for people that had no idea. I was like,
It's fun. I mean, Netflix feels like how I felt. But also the internet wants to know, like, was Shang-Chi like flirting with you?
Oh my gosh. I mean,
the internet has been shipping you and Shang-Chi. They're like, let's get Chriselle in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I know. Actually, I think, you know, we've laughed about this since because I think they did take a few liberties of how they, you know, kind of put that together. He's so lovely. And luckily, he thought it was funny too. But I just feel like I do want to give you a tidbit of behind the scenes on this, because when you watch the show, it looks like the biggest moment was like where I'm like adjusting my shirt and it's like this thing. It looks like, I guess I'm flirting and it's like kind of weird. And just so you know, this is what really happened. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, but I'm going to. But so we're talking, production comes in and goes, Chriselle, you need to adjust your shirt. And I looked down, I was like, oh. And I was like, I'm sorry, you know, and I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And then it's what you see. But just so you know, it wasn't like so annoying. But I mean, that's just like a tiny thing. But that just, you know, because then it looked like I was like, oh, see you. And it just, you know, we were in the middle of a conversation and they were like, hey, Krisha, you know, and I was like, oh, sorry. I didn't ever for a million years think that would be in the show or that would then be a beat that they used. So those little things, I mean, they're harmless. But you know, he's, well, I don't think he wants me to tell his personal situation, but I'm very, very lovely.
I love that. I want to ask about Adam a bit, cause he's produced The Hills first before this show. And, have you gotten any indication from him about sort of like things that he's like fixing that first happened on The Hills that like doesn't want to happen on Selling Sunset? In particular, listen, we know Christine is the show villain, especially this season, but I remember like Heidi on The Hills, right, was sort of in that space too, Heidi and Spencer. But what happened, I feel like, is no one wanted to film with them anymore. And so that, I feel like, made the drama in the show go away later. Have there been conversations with him or just with, like, where you know, like, listen, even if you guys aren't hanging out with Christine outside of the show, you have to at least shoot scenes and be at parties together because, like, that's what the audience wants.
Yeah, and I think that's what you see on this season. You know, we're only in party scenes together because, you know, there are just so many. I mean, there were legal situations happening with people on camera, people off camera, and it makes it really hard to, you know, when those things aren't being addressed, to then, you know, put all that aside and, like, you know, because at the end of the day, I think, you know, clearly she's great for the show. Everybody should be able to get to a place where, you know, we can just see that and kind of come together. When things go that route, it makes it extremely hard to be like, you know, I've been in TV a long time. I've had to work with a lot of people I didn't really care for. So,
yeah.
you know, but it never got to a legal standpoint. And so that's just kind of really hard to work around. So we'll see what happens, but it's just, you know, I think obviously it'd be great for the show. I think the fans would love it if we could, you know, I hear the, you know, I know the feedback from the season was like enough with the drama and, you know, then it looks like, you know, it's just crazy. So it just, it's unfortunate because there's so many things that we can't address or we can't talk about.
Of course,
the show wants to play it in a way where they can't play it completely one-sided because that's no fun, because they want you to still tune in and feel, you know, so, I think it's one, legal things can't be discussed, but also, you know, the show doesn't want to make it too one-sided. So
of course send her to Tampa.
I think, yeah, I just feel like, you know, if hopefully, you know, people have a grasp on, you know, TV and what's good for TV, then I think the goal is to keep things clean. Yes, you can fight and have these stupid arguments, but when things, you know, get lawyers involved and get legal, then it's really gets ugly and it's hard to recover from. And so, yeah, that's kind of where we were. We were trying to work through that and it was difficult.
Okay. Tell us a bit about becoming an author, because you do have a book coming out.
Yay, I do. It's called Under Construction, because living my best life took a little work. I'm in my new house, but you know, it was a...
I can see it on the Zoom, but also I've been there. Your house is gorgeous.
Thank you so much. It's gorgeous. Thank you. Yeah. I love it. But yeah, it's just basically... you know, it started in COVID, just kind of like I was going through some stuff and I was kind of doing a cathartic, just, I mean, also there was literally nothing else to do. And so it started that way. And then it just became, you know, this process of like, you know, of course, as we all do, you want to like get back to when you're good and when you're, you know, like ready to take on the world. And I think it was, you know, so it's a process of kind of going through those things and hopefully being able to like inspire other people that feel like, you know, because life is like, you know, it's like ups and downs and craziness. So hopefully people will laugh. You know, there's a lot of, you know, there's some behind the scenes stuff, obviously, of the show, and just I get to go more in depth of things that I just feel like, you know, with the show, it's like a highlight reel. So,
yeah, I love that. I love that. Oh my God, one last question. Did anyone from Netflix, was anyone from Netflix mad when you were shading that movie, The Guilty?
Oh my gosh, did you see also, if they were, they didn't tell me about it. Because even on Twitter, I kind of, you know, I did the asterisk just so that when you search the name, it doesn't come up. But because that's the weird thing. It's like, am I still allowed to have, you know, my opinions on different things, you know, on the...
I get it. Because I've like written for like 3 Netflix shows and I'm currently on one now. And it's like, when you watch a show on Netflix, you're like, well, I didn't like this movie.
Yeah. So they didn't say anything, but you know, I tried to be, you know, you try not to, but it is weird because there's just so many shows and at least we were talking about it. I don't know.
Yeah. You were ahead of the curve anyway, because then everyone started hating Jake Gyllenhaal the next week once Taylor dropped her album.
I know, the shade of it all. And then Diane Warwick even like jumped in and was like, you give that girl her scarf back. I was dying. But that's the other thing. I think there should be a warning, or at least a disclaimer at the beginning of anything that was filmed. Like, this was filmed during COVID. You know, so that we know, like, it's going to be in one room. No one's going to be close to each other, because that's why we waited to film Selling Sunset. And it took so long to come out, because we just knew that it wouldn't do the show justice if, you know, we had to film it in that way. So,
of course. I mean, and I think, you know, like, you get hints of it when, like, Vanessa is like, you know, like, you know, we're back to open houses now, you know,
yeah,
and stuff like that. So also, have you had these empanadas, and are they good?
I have to say, they are so good. I mean, the tweets and stuff about them are so funny, but 100% just try it, put them in the air fryer, they're delicious. And I don't cook, so I always like just pop them in the air fryer, they're really good. But I know, I hear you on everybody is like laughing, they're really, really good.
God, I love that. Thank you for being here, Chrishell.
Thank you for having
Finally.
Me. Finally. Yes, I know. I'm so excited to see you.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Thomas Jefferson wrote to George Washington. Shout out to my favorite slaveholders. In 1786, that a hereditary aristocracy will change the form of our governments from the best to the worst in the world. In honor of a certain CNN anchor proving our founding fathers correct, we thought we'd take a look at the American dynasties poisoning our democracy, economy, and society. But first, baby,
what happened, girl?
Girl, get the Bravo cameras at the Christmas dinner this year, okay? Because this is giving Housewives of New Jersey drama, okay? Your brother torpedoed your career, and you went along with it.
It's so sinister, though. It's like, it's so sinister, the whole thing, because like, as a longtime New Yorker, we have no love for Governor Cuomo, but during the novel coronavirus crisis, this man like transformed into our daddy. Like every 10 a.m., he's out here giving us information. He's like, here's what's going on. And for a brief moment, some New Yorkers were like, oh, maybe our governor is good. I was not one of those New Yorkers. But still, it was like it truly you felt the atmosphere change, where you were like, oh, like in a world of chaos, like here is someone who is not doing chaos. And there is something like so sinister about finding out that the background of that was that like he was writing a book for like millions of dollars, about to go on a book tour. He was lying about like the coronavirus numbers. And more importantly, that he was like covering up like some really serious like harassment allegations. And like he wrote the harassment laws in New York. So it's not like he doesn't know what he was doing. And I don't know, like finding that out, just it made me so angry, like about the Cuomo governor brother. And then you realize that like the CNN one is like in on the scam as well. And it's just like these families, it's so frustrating. And you like watch them go from like really the top, and they're trying to make you feel like it's all good and cozy and like they take their job seriously. Meanwhile, like all they're in it for is like power and destroying people's lives.
Also, I think what is now in perspective for me now is there were a couple of viral clips of them talking on various news specials where they're talking about like they're like razzing each other and like talking about like the relationship with their mom and like making jokes and stuff. And it's like there was, in retrospect, there was a coziness to this on an actual news show where it's like, why are we taking in the vaudeville of their personal lives while watching a news show. You know, I think the lines were blurred anyway for us, and we liked that initially. And then when we find out, oh, but they're in cahoots, we shouldn't be surprised because we loved that about them, watching that once upon a time. So in a way, it's like we were fools for finding them charming.
Zucker liked that about them. Jeff Zucker liked that about them until it blew up in his face.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but like, I guess like I reject that we were fools. I think that if anything, it gets like, you know, like thrown down our throats. Like we, like, of course, if you are, you know, the 9 p.m. anchor at CNN and your brother is a governor during a crisis, you're the first person who has access to your brother. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, that's mm-hmm. not like, as the viewer, like, I don't make those rules. But there is just something like mm-hmm. so gross about that, like, you know, that performance of just like, oh, this is like totally fine. And we're all like fighting for mom's lasagna or whatever, you know, where they do that thing and really obscure the lines for you. But, you know, there is a reason that there are families like this where one person gets to be like the governor. The older brother is the governor. The other brother is like the highest rated anchor on CNN. And, the, you know, I was like, it's how it's what the family was like built for. Mm-hmm. And they get to be at the highest echelon of like all of these institutions, and people are none the wiser for it because, you know, like I was like, I certainly don't come from a family like that. Mm-hmm. But this is what in like American politics and American media, mm-hmm. that was like kind of like my biggest lesson of moving to New York and moving to America in general, is you talk to people, you know, it's like you get to know their job, and 9 out of 10 times when it's like, oh, I wonder how that person has that job, you're like, oh, this is who your father is. You know, like that's always the answer, almost mm-hmm. always in media. And that is also almost always the answer in politics. So, you know, it's really awful that like that is how that particular sausage is made. And, you know, and most of the time, like mm-hmm. the viewer, the consumer is like doesn't know, but this is how power works in America. Like you have to be the wife of someone, you have to be the son of someone, mm-hmm. you have to be related to someone. And those are the people that like get all of those mm-hmm. opportunities, and it makes, and everything is like the worse for it.
It almost feels like this particular dynasty was like destined to crash and burn, because I mean, Mario Cuomo himself, you know, was out here surviving assassination attempts in Rome and deciding to not run for president. You know, it's like a failed stunt here, and now the brothers have torpedoed themselves as well. And you know, it's like, Chris, you were the hot one.
You expected more, I see.
I expect more from pretty people.
None of them are the hot one. Take it back.
I mean, so even this weekend, talking about another brother dynasty, you've got Alec Baldwin, who, seems like he is, I don't know where the Baldwin name goes anymore, because, you know, you got... Which Baldwin is it? William, the one who's like basically a Republican?
No, that's Stephen.
Stephen. William is the one who was on Gossip Girl, the liberal. We love him. But you know, you got Stephen Baldwin, you got Alec Baldwin. What is it? The Baldwins are starting to feel like the Wahlbergs in the sense of like, please go away.
Well, my favorite dynasty, at least in entertainment, is the Fondas, and I'll tell you why. Well, this shouldn't surprise you. I'm obviously a Jane Fonda-oriented person. But Henry Fonda was such a kind of stoic presence in like American cinema. And Jane Fonda, I felt afterwards, a lot of her career was responding to that stoniness avidly. And in fact, you get a moment of her in, of course, on Golden Pond, talking directly to her father and like begging him to be emotional. And she has talked frequently about how that was a very hard moment. She actually touches his knee and sort of almost breaks down. But it's the rare dynasty where there are public moments where you see her confronting being in a dynasty. What is having this like magnificent figurehead of a family? What has it done to me personally? What are people invested in? I mean, there are several reasons that Jane Fonda is sort of iconoclastic in terms of being a very traditional, all-American-looking screen icon. But that is one of them.
I mean, I find it... Maybe it's because, like, I don't know. Like, I don't come from this kind of family, or it's not appealing. But I think, like, even if I did, even if I was, like, some sort of, like, rich Hollywood kid or whatever, why would you want to do the same job as your parents? Like, haven't they damaged you enough?
That it is like, interesting.
You already know. It's like, why would you want to be compared to like the blueprint of you? Like, why would you want to do that? It just, it makes no sense to me. It's like, on one hand, I get it. It's like, this is the access that you have in life. So sure. Like you're, you know, like they'll help you get a record contract or you'll do it. Like, it's like you have a fast track into a world that like most people don't have a fast track into. But generally I was like, if you're a self-aware person, why would you want to do the job that you're like, why? It just, it makes no sense to me. And there is just something about it that like, you know, sometimes I like get sad for the kids. And then other times you're like, okay, maybe like, I don't know. It's like, I think about like Willow Smith, for example. And like her last, like the latest album is actually like fire and it's so fun. And there is a part of me that's like, okay, I love hearing Willow sing because, you know, it's like you read the Will Smith book and you're like, wow, Will really like robbed Jada of her like burgeoning like goth like singer career. And so there's part of that where it was like, okay, I will allow this, like live out the dream. And also like actually very talented and it's fun. But at the same time, I'm like, it must not be like good for your psyche generally to have people constantly like bring up your parents in the same sentence as you.
But I would say the Greeks would say that we have always been, you know, ruled by these familial lines, you know, and whether or not you're a celebrity or like someone growing up in a powerful family, our responses are sort of the same. Because I mean, I feel like if you look at the trajectory of people who are quote unquote self-made, or, you know, like people who come from working class families, like, you know, like I feel like personally me, you know, a lot of my trajectory comes from coming up in a family that you don't want to have the job of your parents, right? And so like you actually go in the diametrical opposite position of them to try and escape, you know, your circumstances in a way, you know? I feel like the people who aren't that are like people who don't have the sense of like wanting to be within the same industry as their family. It's just because they've seen up close like that it leads to a dead end, at least in terms of what they want, you know?
It also, it feels to me like scions of, you know, popular people in entertainment. I think there's something to be learned from the dynamic between Colin Hanks and Chet Hayes. Like, both of those people, I feel like, are living, they're making decisions in relation to Tom Hanks. Like, there's no way you can be Colin Hanks and not have studied, you know, your dad's career or whatever. But also, something about Chet Hayes, and I don't mean to get into the plethora of issues surrounding Chet Hayes and his persona, but like,
he has one issue with Chet Hayes. Pick one.
This is a, yeah, right. It's like, I still feel like a lot of these decisions are because your dad is Tom Hanks. They feel related to me. So, but here's the thing. This is also what's interesting culturally about being part of a dynasty is because you're related to somebody else famous, I always have a reason to remember you. So it's like you make a decision and that brings me mentally, it reminds me of your dad or it reminds me of your brother or whatever. And it kind of strengthens your celebrity constantly. It's like a self-fulfilling thing.
So you're saying that like Eva Amore, Susan Sarandon, like I'm thinking about that all the time.
Yeah, right. There was a awesome, I think Fran Lebowitz quote where she talks about the children of famous people always say, well, it got, helped me get my foot in the door, but then I had to work really hard once I was there. She goes, getting your foot in the door is the entire process. Like if you're in the room, you won. You're already there. Yeah. I mean, I remember specifically years ago, I interviewed one of my favorites, Angelica Houston. She goes, I fought to be an actress. And literally, this is somebody who was in a movie in the late 60s that her father directed. And it was such a massive flop that she went on a national talk show and apologized to him for her bad performance. And she wasn't in another movie again until the 80s. And then at which point she then picked up again, you know, she was with Jack Nicholson. She had plenty of reason to still be famous. She was a, you know, a model with Richard Avedon and all these people, and then got to act again. Who gets that opportunity? You know, somebody who's still in the picture and then became an Oscar winning actress and a beloved actress. I mean, I think she's great, but it's like to say that you worked and got there when in fact there's just a reason you're there to begin with. Is, you know, so interesting to me.
Right. And there's no shame in that. There's no shame in that, but there is just this like, you know, it's like two American contradictions at work here where everyone wants you to believe that they like work really hard to get what they have. But also it's really nice to be blessed to be born at the right place at the right time. I was like, listen, like you shouldn't feel ashamed of like how you grow up or who you're born to or whatever. But I think that it does behoove people in public life to be really honest about how their lives are possible, because otherwise right. all you're selling to other people are like pipe dreams. It's like why you get like Coltons landing in LA, you know, from like middle of nowhere, Midwest, just being like, oh my God, with this big smile and these looks, like the minute an agent says hello to me, like my career will be made. And you're like, no, your career is a miracle. It's a literal miracle because you worked really hard and you put yourself in these really shitty situations. And that is not possible for everyone.
Well, it's the way we sell it, too. You know, I mean, like the American tradition is sort of built on this. You know, like we think we all, especially from the Midwest, Lewis, you know, growing up around like working class Midwest people, we all go to school with someone who then like moves back home to work for their dad's like roofing business or something. You know, it's like your parents are supposed to be there as sort of like a guiding light for you. But no one is selling like going home and working for the family roofing business as like the entryway into, you know, the yellow brick road of America, mm-hmm. you know? And I do actually want to have a small shout out, though, to something I was thinking about when you brought up Ben Stiller, talking about how hard it is, you know, for a lot of like the children of celebrities and, you know, like the hard part is getting your foot into the door. I actually want to think that maybe they think of it that way, because if you grow up the child of a celebrity, you know the children of other celebrities because that's who you grew up with. And maybe they actually just know that they are the one of the 10 children of celebrities who actually has a career. Because mm-hmm. if you're the child right. of a celebrity, you must know many other children of celebrities who acted in one movie that it never happened again, wrote a screenplay, didn't get greenlit, and you know so many people who actually were not even able to get the foot in the door.
Right, because it doesn't work for 100% of kids of celebrities. You assume, oh, it is just, you know, hard work and
it's our family. I guess that's so hard
for me. You know, it's so hard for me to even like laugh at this, because I'm like, are you serious? Sure, like you're growing up in a scarcity mentality. Like I hear you. It's like all the profiles of like the canceled girl bosses who are always like, I thought I was poor, but we were only like single digit millionaires. We weren't like multiple digit millionaires. So I thought we had nothing. We were like, okay, like whatever. It just like shows you like how small and insular their world is. And that is also just like really hard for people who at least like grow up in LA and New York. I'm willing to forgive that from like someone who does not have like an entree into mm-hmm. the larger world. But I'm like, I'm sorry, if you're growing up as a coastal elite and you don't have a sense of awareness of like, oh, the world is big and different and people have multiple opportunities, then again, you know, I'm like, now I think that you're not smart and mm-hmm. I refuse to like buy into your talent at all, because it's so crazy to like feel sympathy. It's for like people like this when they have zero awareness of the world that they're born into at all. It's like you don't even deserve it if you don't know how special it is.
Well, I'll leave you with this final note. Is it sad to be privileged and wealthy but creatively unfulfilled?
Wow.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of anybody whose story this is. I'm sure there's a correct answer.
Yeah. You know, I'm just, you know, like that's the sadness of being the child of a celebrity or dynasty who can't, you know, no one wants to read your play. No one wants
if
to read
no one
your
wants
novel.
To read your play and you come from one of these families, please tweet at us. We want to hear from you.
There's a lost Minnelli. Yes. Come reach out to us. Yeah.
Jason Schwartzman, if you have work out there that like your like family won't get made, please holler at me. I like unapologetically stand for the Coppolas. I was like, this family is wild. I was like, they do everything. I was like, they're out here like, we make wine, we make movies, we make TV, we make Wes Andersons, like we're here for you. If there's like an unread play, holler at us. Ira will produce it now that he knows what escrow is. He's about to make it.
Speaking of Jason Schwartzman.
Can theater go into escrow? My play is in
escrow.
Anything
can go into escrow, baby.
Speaking of Talia Shire, please say hi to us. What are you doing? I want to know how you're a two-time Academy Award nominated woman and you're the mother of Jason Schwartzman, and I want to know how things are.
I know. Jason Schwartzman, just get in touch. Get in touch. We want to hear all about your family. Get in touch.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode, Keep It. Amina, I'm going to let you go first. What is your Keep It this week?
Man, my Keep It actually made me really, I've been like really upset about it on multiple levels. So if you are not familiar with Alice Siebold, she is the author of this really, really, really popular memoir named Lucky, in which she like describes being raped. And then she later tells the police that she saw a black man on the street who she believed was her attacker. A man was like named Anthony Broadwater, was arrested and convicted. And he spent 16 years in prison for this crime. And when he was released, he was on the sex offender list. And you can, you know, like it's like being in jail like constantly. Alice Siebold's like memoir really like for people who read it and for like when it was published is like one of the like first really prominent accounts of like a woman describing what it's like to be sexually assaulted and like, you know, having like the havoc that it like does onto your life, you know, and she chooses to like engage with the criminal justice system in like the early 80s. Even in, I went back and reread the book recently, and it's interesting to like read that book, you know, like with 2021 goggles, and see it. And, you know, on one hand, there is the like immense amount of like compassion and empathy that you can have for someone who is like telling you about their sexual assault. And I think a lot of people are familiar with her other book, The Lovely Bones, which was like adapted as a movie and, you know, like very successful. And again, like that engages with that topic. But long story short, when like Lucky is like being made into a movie, a producer on the movie is like, this script is not really like lining up with like a kind of like the story in the book. Like what's going on here? And in doing like his job of producing, he starts having these doubts about like, did this story happen like as this woman said that it happens? And he basically gets like fired from that production because he's like doing too much producing. He's asking too many questions. And he ends up like hiring a private investigator to like look into like, I want to know, like, did this man like really commit the rape that he was accused of? And lo and behold, the private investigator is like, nope, like that's not what happened. This man got convicted on like two things. This like bogus, like, hair analysis, like anything that's like forensic science is actually not science. It's just like crap science. So like CSI has done like more havoc on our society than we think it has. And also like the other thing he gets accused on is her like, CS lie. And the other thing he gets accused on is like this woman literally like pointing at him in court being like, it was him. This is the black man who like, who raped me. And, you know, and for years he has like gone, like Anthony Broadwater has like denied that he was, that he ever did this crime. He in fact like didn't get paroled because he refused to like admit that he had done the crime. And you can imagine what like being on a sex offender registry like does to someone's life. And Alice Siebold is now confronted with all this evidence. Like Anthony Broadwater has now been exonerated. Like it's like the court has gone back and was like, oh yeah, we 100% fucked up. And all Anthony Broadwater asked for was for an apology. He was like, I would like an apology from this woman. And here's a woman who is like a critically acclaimed writer. And the apology is like we are writers, so we know, you know, like the apology is, she writes it in the passive voice. I'm sorry for what was done to you. Like she was not complicit in what was done to him.
Classic.
And, you know, and it's not my apology to accept or any of our apologies to accept. And Anthony Broadwater has accepted it. It was his own nightmare. And I'm just like really struck by like the grace that he is extending to this person and the way that he has really like tried to rebuild his life. And Alice Siebold, like, we all know that something really awful happened to you. Like I am a survivor of sexual assault. And I'm just like, it's like I viscerally like understand and like believe her that this like terrible thing happened to her. But in the way that she has like handled the aftermath of it all, as someone who's like, she has made so much money and an entire reputation like based on this, like these two accounts of, you know, like these really like jarring, like, you know, like sexual violence that can happen to women. I was so grossed out by the apology. I was like, this is so lacking. You are someone who like knows how to use your words and you are using them here with like violence, frankly, and you're being very weaselly. And it's just like so shocking to see. So to Alice Siebold, like fucking keep it. It's terrible. Like a man's life was ruined and, you know, and you can do better. Like, this is not okay.
the passive voice thing. I think the most classic example of that is mistakes were made. Who said mistakes were made? That's like the classic example of not owning something, using verbiage to cover your tracks.
Reagan used the phrase mistakes were made in 1987 discussing, you know, the Iran-Contra affair.
Yes. Also, Richard Nixon also used it several times, which is among the most Nixon-y phrases one can say, I think.
Yeah. So if you're a writer and you are coming out using Republican president doublespeak, maybe re-examine yourself. Lewis, what is your keep it?
My favorite thing to do is to have a keep it that I'll soon have to eat my words because he'll eventually be amazing in the role he's just been cast as. But for now, I just don't see it. Keep it to the alleged new Fred Astaire biopic starring Tom Holland. Here's what I think happened. People remember Tom Holland doing that lip sync battle Umbrella where he does Singing in the Rain, which is Gene Kelly, not Fred Astaire.
Iconically.
Okay, right. Well done.
I know. Please give him credit. Yeah. Like, please.
Did we maybe fawn a little too hard when he did the Rihanna section? I'm going to say yes. Like, oh, the cute straight person doing the Rihanna. I don't know. It was like, it's a B for me. It's a B. But anyway, as Fred Astaire, first of all, Fred Astaire is a very, shall we say, distinct looking man. He is pointy in all sorts of ways that actors are just not now. He is... obviously an incredibly talented dancer, Tom Holland. Yeah, talented dancer. They don't look a thing alike. Now, I am, at the moment, obsessed with Nicole Kidman in Being the Ricardos, which is my favorite actress performance of the year. I thought she was amazing. So I'm not saying it's impossible to inhabit the role of somebody you really don't look much like at all. I'm just saying, man, Fred Astaire is the talent level... And the weirdness of how he looks. I just don't see Tom Holland, who is, you know, an all-American pretty boy, doing the job. I just don't see it. I don't see him as an old-school celebrity. And also, I guess we haven't really seen him in many serious roles. I mean, I'm not to say that Spider-Man isn't serious, but not true-to-life seriousness. So I'm just in disbelief. I just don't see it.
It's not?
Okay, go on.
Listen, I will also say that, for one, you are forgetting, because he is Spider-Man and Peter Parker, Tom Holland is an all-American pretty boy. That boy is British.
I know. He's very British.
Tom Holland facially is like another Tom Daly. You know, like, his face is drawn on graph paper. It's perfection. Fred Astaire, meanwhile, has, like, you know, something elfin about him.
I will say that I have not seen... Tom Holland's dramatic works, mostly because every film that he has done, aside from Spies in Disguise, shout out, that isn't a Marvel movie, I actually have no interest in seeing. Those are usually like weird war movies or like The Devil All the Time. I was like, I don't know what this is, baby.
Do we not Cherry... think of Billy Elliot as like a dramatic performance?
Yeah, but he was a baby.
I know, but like, it's the body of work, baby. Like,
that's fair. That's fair.
Gotta look at the whole man.
I do enjoy the film The Impossible. And I do think he's good in The Impossible from what I remember, but it's been ages since I've seen it.
I think he'll be great as Fred Astaire. And you know what? I don't know. Whoever the cast is, Ginger Rogers. So,
yeah, I wonder who that
probably
be.
Nicole Kidman. Probably Nicole Kidman.
So... My keep
Ira,
it,
what's your keep it?
My keep it is to Alec Baldwin.
Oh, but why?
Well, there's many reasons. There's always a reason.
I was like, which crimes? Which crimes?
But after we dealt with the horrific, tragedy that happened on the...
Oh, Kim Basinger's Oscar. Oh, no.
We're not doing that again either, Lewis. You know how I feel about LA Confidential, and frankly, the disrespect must stop.
Mini Driver Hive, where are you? Go ahead.
Me, Mini Driver Hive. See? The podcast is amazing. Listen to the Mini Driver podcast. It's so good. Mini Driver's the best.
Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about the shooting on the set of Rust. which we've already discussed on the show. It was a horrific tragedy, and it killed cinematographer Halna Hutchins and wounded the director, Joel Souza. The last thing I expected after this tragedy was for an exclusive sit-down with Alec Baldwin, where he says the phrase, "Someone is responsible for what happened." And I can't say who that is, but I know it's not me. Baby.
Mistakes were made.
No, it's exactly mistakes were made. It's the same thing.
Mistakes were made.
What are you doing? No one like really thought that Alec Baldwin would like put a bullet in this gun and was actually responsible trying to commit a murder. But also with everything that we've heard about the film set, about, you know, the crew walking off, about the scabs working, just basically the unsafe conditions of a film that you were starring in and also a producer on, some responsibility needs to be taken for the environment that was created here. And to have a ABC special basically where you're denying any involvement and just like shifting all blame, it's just really wild to me. It's wild that this was the route that we chose.
And he also said that the trigger wasn't pulled, correct? It was like,
yes,
it was a magical gun moment or something.
It is possible for, like, you know, all of those scenarios. I think that, like, what was really hard for me about that interview is how he, you know, and like, I get it, like, he is at the center of this like horrible tragedy, but you know, talk about like being selfish and so self-centered. I was like, there is a family that's like grieving their loved one. Like, it's not about, you know, it's not about us and like the referendum on Alec Baldwin, but I was just like, the cruelty of like imagining her husband or her child like watching this interview or just being subjected to, like, every time you know, Halina Hutchins' names is mentioned, it's like in the same breath as like Alec Baldwin, and the story is about him. I was like, that is just like particularly cruel and it's awful. And it's like, well, there's a way for this process to come out and to, like, you know, for her family to get the like kind of closure that they need and that they want, frankly. But the way that he is going about doing it is, you know, it's the most like Alec Baldwin, I am the center of the universe thing, and it's disgusting.
And it seems to be in direct response, you know, to people on the right capitalizing on this because they hate Alec Baldwin because he hates Trump. And now we're stuck more in this, well, I need to frame this in my own way in opposite to this. It's like, it's just not needed.
Yeah. Alec Baldwin will be shocked to know that there are people who do not like Trump and do not like Alec Baldwin. And I am square in the like center of that Venn diagram. I was like, I don't need either of you. And frankly, I hope that you cancel each other out. Please take them both out.
By the way, the George Stephanopoulos interview just in general was so softball. It was so like bump set, like setting every question up so that Alec could spike it easily. There was just
I'm shocked he didn't give him a hug. Yeah. I'm shocked he didn't hug him. Mm-hmm. It was so gross.
Well, you know, the George Stephanopoulos industrial complex is its own thing to examine. So, you know.
Or not examine. I will not be giving George Stephanopoulos 5 more seconds of my brain power. Like, absolutely not.
Actually, when I think about George Stephanopoulos, the most I think about is like when he was a part of like a Friends episode, just the plot. They kept saying that they could see him across, like, they thought he was like in the apartment across the street. I don't know. I don't remember Friends plots that much. Some white listener of the show probably remembers the episode better than I do. But
I mean, American Crime Story impeachment has some Stefano, you know, like he was very much at the center of like that drama. So if you're looking for some like Stephanopoulos, like you're like missing that in your TV diet. Yeah. That's ACS impeachment is for you.
Some Stefanoffa lore, if you will. Okay.
And I won't. So that's enough.
Anyway, I choose to pretend that Alec Baldwin vanished to another dimension after 30 Rock. So thank you to Amina for being here this week.
As always.
Yes, as always. Love having you on the show. And thank you to Chriselle for joining me as well. And be sure to go listen to When Diana Met... I think you'll all love the episode When Diana Met Ira Madison III.
It is juicy. Okay.
I bet.
Iconic six episode. Iconic six episode.
Okay. Okay. It is me, Diana, a Ouija board, and a lot of Pinot Grigio.
That I can picture. Yeah. This became griddly real just a second ago.
You know. All right. We'll be back with more Keep It next week, our final episode of the year. Woo!
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. But I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.